Even before Huckleberry and Jim set out on their raft nearly 130 years ago, the allure of the Mississippi River was strong. And today, the river still calls to adventurers. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Last summer, Ben Hawksh launched his canoe in the waters of Lake Itasca, Minnesota, the source of the Mississippi. 6 months later, he arrived at the Gulf of Mexico. Today, I'll talk with him about his journey along the entire length of the Mississippi in a solo canoe. Then later in the hour, I'll talk with Iowa State University alum Jeremy Canelia, the winner of the International Horror Guild Award for Best Artist in Dark Fantasy and Horror. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with artist Jeremy Carnelia about his work as an award-winning illustrator and fantasy and horror. But first, we're going to focus on a real-life adventure. Last summer, Ben Hawksh, a graduate student in ecology at the University of Northern Iowa, launched his canoe into the waters of Lake Itasca, Minnesota, which, of course, you know is the source of the Mississippi River. About 6 months later, he arrived at the Gulf of Mexico, and today he's with me in the studio to talk about his adventures. Ben, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for the opportunity, Charity.
So tell me, what gave you the idea? What made you want to spend about 6 months in a solo canoe traveling down the Mississippi River?
Yeah. Well, I didn't really know the answer to that question until I was done, but I was able to think of a variety of answers to that along the way. One of them is because I simply can. The Mississippi is a main artery through the United States. You know, the fur traders used to use it. People are still using it today. There's a variety of public land along it. And it was something that, you know, I just wanted to do. But, you know, my father grew up on the Mississippi River up in Lansing, Iowa, in Al McKee County. And, you know, sometimes I'll blame him for inspiring me to do this. But
Was it something that you thought about doing for many years, or was it a recent idea?
Well, it was kind of always in the back of my head. But I met a fella about 2 years before I started, and I saw the fire kind of burning in his eyes, and I wanted to feel that kind of energy that he had from it. And so I took off, you know?
And what point were you at in your life that enabled you to do this, to just pick up and leave for 6 months?
Yeah, well, I just graduated from the university. My father runs a hardware store in Johnston. I didn't want to get a real job, so I went and worked for him for a little while. And I'd had a little bit of backcountry experience. You know, you and I outdoors provided me with a great opportunity to kind of get my backcountry skills in place. And I just packed up and left.
What kind of gear did you have for setting off on this journey?
Yeah, I had a 16.5-foot Winona canoe sitting in the middle. I had two paddles with me, and I kind of approached it like a backcountry hiking trip, but I have to keep everything dry. I had a 5-gallon water jug, which was really important. You know, I could fill up in towns I'd get to along the way. I had a tent and a sleeping bag, a sleeping pad, a big knife strapped to my leg just in case, I fell in and got tangled in something, worst case scenario. But I think the most important thing was just the will to stay on the river, because a lot of times I didn't really want to be on the river.
What did you have for safety? You had a knife, but you didn't carry a cell phone with you.
Didn't carry a cell phone. I really just relied on the experience that I'd had traveling. I knew that people were always there to help in case, something went wrong. And, the instances where there weren't people around, the wilderness up in the north or down south past Port Eads, where there's no roads, you just have to be very aware of the situation that you're getting into and to make sure there's an exit if you get into a situation.
And did you have good maps and all that kind of information that you would need? I mean, obviously you're going to follow the river, but did you do a lot of research to know about your surroundings?
You know, I really didn't. I really didn't want to do much research on it. My father wasn't too excited about that. You know, I didn't read any books. I really didn't want to know what I was going to get myself into. You know, I'd spent some time, you know, canoeing for a week or two. I'd hiked for 7 to 10 days at a time. I'd traveled in other countries. And I really knew that if, you know, I was well prepared, I could get through the situation. You know, there were sections up in northern Minnesota, you know, the floating bogs that they can't even map. Imagine a floating mat of vegetation that's the size of a house or even the size of a city block. And as the channel meanders through this wetland, chunks will break off and shift. And, well, you have to look down at the water and see which way the vegetation is trailing to see which direction you should go through the wild rice that's over your head. And a lot of times, you know, I was just really ready to experience whatever I ran into and approached it that way.
Well, and of course, in Iowa, we think about the Mississippi as nearly a mile wide and a very powerful river. But when you started up at Lake Itasca, it's not much of a river to begin with.
No, not at all. And I relate it to more of like a mountain stream that you would see in Colorado. It's there's tall pine trees. There's even sections of rapids that you have to portage around, or if you can't, or if they surprise you, you end up having to go straight through them. And it isn't really until you hit the St. Croix River where Minnesota and Wisconsin meet up that it really, really changes into the river that we know as Iowa.
On your website, you have published just a few days of your journal, and you kept a journal the entire time you were out on the river. And those first couple of days, it was even the very first day that you kind of overestimated what you were capable of. You ended up doing some paddling in the dark. What was going through your mind as you were scrambling at the end of that first day?
Yeah, so, well, honestly, what have I gotten myself into? There's a series of maps that the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources provides that, you know, show some campsites, and I got kind of a late start during the day, and I wanted to get to the second campsite, and, you know, I had a couple of gallons of water in the canoe, and, you know, there are these braided channels where you come around a corner and all of a sudden it splits off in two distinct directions. You don't know necessarily where to go. I was honestly a bit scared. You know, I say in the journals that I let the fear take over. I wasn't completely processing what was happening. I wasn't being safe with the way I was approaching it. But I took day two off. I collected myself, got all my gear dried out, and made a couple of commitments, and I tried to stick to them.
That's a lot of time to be by yourself. And of course, as you traveled further, there was less wilderness, there were more people, and you met a number of people along the way. But in those early days, and even later when you were on the river, that's a lot of time just by yourself. What was going through your head? What did you think about during those hours?
Yeah, well, I did a lot of singing. You know, it was always great to see how the ecosystem changed along the way. You know, how the river town slowly appeared, how the trees would change. You know, if I woke up in the morning and saw there was a little bit of yellow in the leaves, I knew I had to paddle a little bit harder. But a lot of times, it was just trying to experience the river itself. You know, I was looking forward to getting to the next town to meet some people or to do some fishing later in the day. And a lot of times it was very hard for me to get through a whole afternoon, especially if it was really windy or starting to rain a bit. And I remember, you know, when the wilderness kind of cleared out to the south, I took to rescuing insects out of the river. So I'd scoop up bees and butterflies and moths and wasps and set them on my knee and, you know, feed them a little bit of apple or grapefruit, you know, just to have a little bit of company for the trip. And, you know, honestly, that really helped out, just the little things.
Did you kind of have to train yourself to be okay with being by yourself?
Yeah. I really hadn't spent that much time. You know, it was 134 days, and you know, when it would get really tough, I would head into a town and I would try to meet people. No, I don't think there was any way for me to really train for it, but it definitely, if I wanted to make it work, I had to make it work.
We talked a little bit about your gear. What did you eat along the way? What were your plans for eating, at least? Let's start with that.
Yeah, well, I planned to try to see how long I could last on wild foods, but I missed the wild rice harvest. I was a little bit early, and the lotuses were still blooming, so I couldn't harvest any of the fruits or tubers from them. So I dove into my dried goods on the first day, you know, the rice and the dried beans, which I ate a lot of. But I made sure to harvest a lot of wild greens to try to get, you know, my fresh vegetables from that source. I did a lot of fishing up until I got through Iowa, and oyster mushrooms were fruiting in abundance along the river, so I was able to pick those. And once I got up into Iowa, you know, towards August and September, the lotus nuts, you know, a lot of times you'll see them in dried flower arrangements. They look like shower heads with little rattly seeds inside of them. If you get those at the right time of the year when they're still green, you throw them on the coals of a campfire, and they're just a really good treat.
How much money did you budget for this trip?
Yeah, well, I had some credit card debt when I left town for it. I had a little bit of money saved up. I had a payment plan going on with the bank to try to make it all work. And I brought a banjo with me, and I went and played my first gig in town, you know, just ended up on a street corner, and I made $63 in my first day. So I figured that was enough food to last me about a week, week and a half. So I went straight to the bank and paid off my credit card with the savings that I had, and I had about $300 when I got south to Wabasha, Minnesota, you know, another 90 days left in the trip. And, you know, I ran out of money, but I made it work.
Did you run into any problems with your canoe? I mean, you're very dependent on your canoe for this journey. Did it get damaged?
It got damaged, yeah. The rapids up north, you know, some very shallow areas, some big glacial erratics in the middle of the streams. I definitely I met a fella along Cass Lake, Minnesota, who was a third-generation boat builder, and he helped me fix up my canoe. And also came untied from underneath a bridge one time and floated about a mile and a half downstream. Good thing I met a fellow named Butch who ran a convenience store, and he temporarily closed and drove me around for about an hour running through backyards to find it. And it was caught up in a willow tree, you know, a little bit ways downriver. And I made sure to check my knots after that.
I'll bet you thought maybe this had come to an end at that point.
Yeah.
All right, we have to take a short break. I'm talking with Ben Hawk. She is a graduate student in ecology at the University of Northern Iowa. And last June, he set out on a trip down the Mississippi River in a solo canoe. 134 days later, he arrived in the Gulf of Mexico. We're talking about his journey today. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up later in the hour, I'm going to talk to artist Jeremy Cornelia about his award-winning work as an illustrator in fantasy and horror books and movies. But right now, I'm talking with Ben Hawk. She is a graduate student in ecology at the University of Northern Iowa. And before he started graduate school, he spent about 6 months traveling down the Mississippi River in a canoe, all by himself. He started out last June up in Minnesota and wound up in the Gulf of Mexico in December. And we were talking before the break about how much money you allowed yourself for the trip, which basically it sounds like none.
It's a pretty good estimate,
right?
Yeah.
But you took your banjo along with you, and your idea was that you could busk for money if you needed to?
Yeah, that was the idea, and it seemed to work fairly well. You know, I could show up in a town and tell a couple of stories, attract a small crowd. Some little kids would get a kick out of it, and, you know, their parents would throw a couple dollars. I could wander into a bar restaurant, and I'd be able to set up in the garden, and they'd provide me a little meal or let me play for tips. But as I got farther south, I realized it was a little bit easier to make money north of the Missouri River confluence.
Why do you think that is?
I really don't have an answer. You know, a lot of the river towns are farther away from the Mississippi down there. There's a lot of flood walls up, and a lot of them have been abandoned through flooding or changes in economic situations. And it felt like other people were also trying to make a little bit of money, you know?
So you actually, at some point in Mississippi, you ran out of money.
Yeah, I ran out of money, and more importantly, I ran out of food. And I had a bit of rice left, but it'd been kind of hard going for about a week there. A very industrial part of the river as well. Not a lot of, you know, the iconic bluffs and backwaters of the Mississippi. So I was kind of out of my element, you know, and a little malnourished, and, you know, end up pulling into a town imagining to set up and make another $63 when, in fact, run into a situation where everyone else is kind of, you know, looking for a little bit of help themselves. Remember, I resorted to the Salvation Army to go try to get some cans of food, but they were only open on Wednesdays from 10 to 11:30. And there was a fellow who noticed the concern in my eyes, and he had mentioned how he's in the same situation. And, you know, if I get walking down the highway and turn left there, head right there about 4 or 5 miles, I'll be able to find another one. And he'd made the walk himself. And it was quite the opportunity for me to experience what it's like for, you know, a lot of people out there, something I'd never ran into. But I put myself in the situation because I wanted to see what it was like to live along the river, whether it be in the wilds of Minnesota or the busy city of, Minneapolis or down in the Delta and, you know, people living hard.
So you think that experience helped you understand a little bit of what it is like to not have what you need to survive on?
Yeah, definitely. And it was very powerful. I mean, I had a little over $5 in my pocket. A lot of it was change. I think $2 of it was on a debit card I'd been holding on to from all the way north in Minnesota. And I remember walking into the grocery store and just being overwhelmed by the sheer abundance of food, but I couldn't buy any of it. I spent about an hour wandering around trying to count calories to find the best bang for my buck. And I remember leaving, you know, just as I almost left my banjo in the grocery store because I was so excited about the 50-cent lemon pie that I'd bought. I was eating it, you know, ravenously on the way out, and one of the ladies had to call me back in to grab it.
Let's talk about the river, because we've talked about how in Minnesota it's not as much of a river. And then, of course, as it comes into Iowa, it gets to be really big. You also start sharing the river with barges, with motorboats, with houseboats. Even a few riverboats are still out there. What was that like when suddenly there's traffic on the river?
Yeah, well, it was nice in some instances, you know, to see other people actually out there using it. You know, I'd gotten to know it pretty well myself, and I was looking forward to meeting other people that were recreating out there as well. You know, and it's all part of it. You know, the river is wildlife habitat, the river is recreation for people, it's industry. You know, there's water coolant plants, the barges coming up and down, and it was good to see people out there. You know, I had to be a little bit careful with some of the barge traffic sometimes, but as long as you didn't get yourself in an inside bend when there was one coming upstream and one coming downstream, you were usually all right.
What's it like to go through one of the locks?
Yeah, well, there's about 12 dams up in Minnesota before you get to the first lock and dam in Minneapolis, St. Paul at Upper St. Anthony Falls. And I didn't have a marine radio, so you paddle up and you go and you pull on a little chain, and it's like a little McDonald's speaker there. And there's like, I'd like one lock entry, please. And, they say about 5 minutes, and you back up, and the big gates will open up. The one in Burlington, Keokuk, excuse me, it actually goes straight down into the water. And you paddle in, and you're surrounded by these giant walls. And sometimes they'll have you hold on to a little cord on the side or a floating buoy. Or sometimes, if you're the only guy there, they'll let you just sit out in the middle and lay back in the canoe. And, they don't use any electricity to pump the locks. So they just open up a gate on the top, the water rushes in, open up a gate on the bottom, the water rushes out. And, as long as there wasn't a barge there waiting, I'd get right through them.
What do you think the most dangerous thing you encountered was?
I think it was myself. The people were good. Even some people that, were telling some stories that made them not sound like good people were being very good to me. I think... when I kind of got the fear up in Minnesota, it was dangerous because I wasn't being careful. And sometimes, I'd be in a town and I'd almost hope that my canoe would get, nicked by somebody. It's like, oh, shucks, I have to go home because, it was hard being by myself. And I think just the little tricks that my mind was playing on me was the most dangerous thing, because if I wasn't sharp, I would get myself into a situation I couldn't easily get out of.
You mentioned the wilderness up north, the public land along the river. So there were campsites. There were places for you to camp. As you went further south, where did you sleep?
Yeah, well, a variety of places. I could sleep on the abundant sandbars because, there was quite the drought last year. Actually, up in Minnesota, up in the Northland, they had quite the flood in the spring. So it was the opposite. But I spent the night on plenty of sandbars. I was also able to stay in some more luxurious settings, So in St. Louis, I ended up randomly meeting a fella who sent somebody to pick me up in a truck, and he took me down through the heart of St. Louis, and I was given the key to his penthouse suite on the fourth floor of this apartment complex that had a bar restaurant on the main floor that he owns, and I had my tab and my food covered all night. Or I'd stay in a camper that someone would let me stay in if I was helping him work for a day or two. I always wanted to set up a hammock, on a backwater on a fallen tree, and sleep over the river, but I never got to do that one.
And you did have a hammock with you.
Yeah.
That was your dad's idea, right?
That was my dad's idea, and I was glad for that. He wasn't too excited about me taking the trip, but there were a couple of things that he had me do. One day I was working for him at the hardware store. He was upset that I wasn't preparing, so he paid me for a couple of hours to go read a blog that he had found online, and that was nice of him.
So you went out there without a cell phone, and your dad wasn't very excited about you doing it. You had a girlfriend back home as well. I'm sure a lot of people who cared about you. How did you keep in touch with them along the way?
Public libraries. Oh, there's such a great, great opportunity there. I'd wander in and, be a little dirty, and folks would recognize I wasn't from town. They'd let me get online, and, I'd get on Facebook and make an update, send out a couple of emails. A lot of times when I was, looking for a friend in a town or trying to make a couple of dollars, folks would recognize that I wasn't from there, and I was, what are you doing here? Well, I'd share a story, and, maybe it'd be a mother that overheard me, and she'd, when was the last time you called your mom? Pull out her cell phone, said, I don't care what you say, call her right now. So people were always really, really willing to help. I think that's because, a lot of them had dreamed of doing it themselves, or some adventure like that as well, or given the opportunity to help someone on a journey is always something that I think people look for.
When I talk to my kids about dangerous situations, I tell them that if they're in trouble and I'm not there, they should look for a mom. Was that advice that you followed when you were on your journey?
Yes. If I really needed a shower or I really needed something, I always made sure to find a mom. It really helped out if they had kids that had left for college or, that were about my age, because, you know, even single parents, you know, were willing to invite me back to their home and stay in their kid's old bed and, you know, feed me just like they did their own children.
What are some of the jobs that you did for a day to help out? What are some of the things that you could do to earn a little money or a little food?
Yeah, Cass Lake, Minnesota was probably the best example of that. I spent 3 days, volunteering for a fella. You know, there was a big storm that wiped out a big section of a lot of timbers and made some docks float away up on Cass Lake. And, you know, we were fixing some boats and repairing some of the boat covers that people had. But a lot of it was just kind of showing up in town with the banjo and providing a little bit of, I mean, just a little something new. People were excited to have me, even if I played one or two songs. You know, they'd still wanted to take care of the river guy. You know, they may remember someone who came through the year before and try to help them out. But I didn't want to seem like I was begging for something. I wanted to try to reciprocate it. So, you know, I remember I was in Hannibal, Missouri. And there was a lady who was working at a bar restaurant, and she let me go back to her home and take a shower. Well, her children were there when she was working, and I gave them a little history on some of the rocks that I had found. I found a couple of geodes and an old arrowhead, and I kind of traced them out on a piece of paper and wrote down what they were and gave them to them as a gift. You know, I may have not always had a tangible job to do, but it was my mission to try to share my experience with people, and I hope that was good enough.
The Mississippi in the South is very different from the Mississippi in the North. What was it like when you got down there and there were alligators and you just a very different world?
Yeah. Well, once you get south of Baton Rouge, the oil refineries really pick up. There's heavy barge traffic. There's ocean-going liners that make an incredible wake if they're in the right place and you're in the wrong place. And, you know, I was covering about 45 miles a day until I got to about that section of the river. And from then on, it was about 20 miles a day if I was lucky. You know, I kind of felt like an ant, you know, felt like I was in the redwood forest, you know, dodging ships and yeah, not being in a place where I probably should have been.
How did you know that you were almost at the Gulf of Mexico? What signs did you see that let you know that you were almost there?
Well, about 100 miles up, I ran into some fellows that were fishing, and they were telling me about how the salt water actually runs up below the Mississippi River for up to 100 miles up north. You know, they're catching stingrays, you know, up north of New Orleans because the water is more dense, and when the tide rises, it comes. You know, and that's a good question. Like, when does the river really end? You know, was it when it started to get a little more salty? Was it when I got to St. Louis, you know, or excuse me, New Orleans? Was it, you know, 93 miles past New Orleans where you got to mile marker zero and the head of the passes? Because that's officially the end of the river if you're going by the Army Corps. And then from there, you've got three different passes you can take. You know, is it at the end of the pass where it opens up to the open Gulf? You know, where the Army Corps maintains a 3-mile channel that goes all the way out into the open Gulf of Mexico. So do I have to paddle all the way out to the end of that buoy where the trench is officially done? And I just kind of came to the conclusion that, you know, the river never really ends. You know, I'm kind of still on it. You know, it's more of a mentality of trying to share what I've been given and trying to learn from the people around me to try to really, you know, see what I can do.
So when we started talking and I asked you why you did this, you said you had to do it to figure out why. So what did you figure out? Why did you take this journey?
Yeah. I met that fella who had been on the river, and I saw the fire in his eyes. You know, he had this confidence about him, but I wanted to feel. And, you know, in my field, you know, restorative ecology, you know, Iowa, it's kind of an uphill battle in some instances. And I wanted to be able to gain this confidence to be able to share with others kind of a sense of place that I've been able to foster. You know, I'd be paddling down the river and there'd be an old cattle yard, and one of the fence posts would be a little bit rotten and the wire would be rusted, but the bottom rung would be clean. You know, someone had just repaired it. You know, you'd paddle by a stream entrance and there was a chunk of limestone with a fossilized shell. Or you'd get to go around another bend and there'd be a broken down building with a mulberry tree growing up through the middle of it. And, you know, just the idea that I'm in, you can sense the past, the present, and the future all in one specific moment. And that makes a place important. And if I could convey that message to people about my trip and about things that they do, because it was all about the people who really made the trip, you know, who made these experiences for me. I feel like it's something that was worth my time and could be worth other people's.
How do you think it changed you?
It was humbling. You know, it kind of started off where, you know, I'd show up into a town and I was excited to tell people I was paddling the Mississippi River. You know, maybe because I was a little low on money or because I was just still, it was a new thing for me. But as the trip wore on, you know, and I was in a situation where maybe I didn't have any money or, you know, I just had more time by myself, I realized that that really wasn't the way to go about it. I needed to provide reciprocation. So, you know, I remember talking to people for hours at a time before they finally asked me what I was doing. And, you know, once I finally did tell them what I was doing, it's like, oh my gosh, what, this is why you're here. This is all these things. And, you know, it just gave me a sense of confidence about where I am. I don't need to try to reaffirm things with people right off the bat, you know, that I can just kind of let it happen and not push a situation.
Ben, thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
And you are working on a book, right?
Yes, I'm working on a book. I've got a website, and I've got a few days of journal entries on there. I think after the summer, I may have something to put out to people.
All right. Well, keep us posted.
Thank you.
And be careful. Ben Hoksh is a graduate student in ecology at the University of Northern Iowa. Last year, he completed a trip solo in a canoe all the way down the Mississippi River. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The paintings of Jeremy Canelia can stop you in your tracks. He focuses on oil paintings, and his work has been featured on the covers of more than 50 CDs and books by people like Stephen King, Ray Bradbury, Douglas Clegg, and Max Brooks. He's also the winner of the International Horror Guild Award for Best Artist in Dark Fantasy and Horror, and his work has been published in two collections. The most recent book released in 2012 is I Before E, Except After Death. He'll be speaking at Iowa State University, his alma mater, tonight at 7 o'clock in the auditorium at the College of Design, and we're here with me now. Hello, Jeremy.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And as we get started, I want to mention that we've put up a link to a slideshow of your work on our Facebook page. So as we talk about your work, if people want to take a look at it, they can go to our Facebook page in Iowa Public Radio and see some of your work. And I do want to mention some of it is extremely disturbing. Other work is extremely beautiful. So just beware before you click over. And I mentioned that you focus in your work in oil paintings. Can you describe your style for us?
Well, my style, it's referred to now as the art of the fantastic. And when I say fantastic, it kind of resonates back. It's a visual narrative. And when they say fantastic nowadays, it was a combination of horror, dark fantasy, science fiction. But in the visual narrative state of things, it goes back to the mythological, religious, allegorical, and even political paintings that resound, you know, even back to the Renaissance. There's a whole movement now that encompasses all the old historical painting movements into the more modern contemporary painters like myself. So we call it now the art of the fantastic.
And the colors that you choose for so much of your work, when you say it dates back to the Renaissance, I can see that in the colors that you select. Is that your hope to evoke that time?
Exactly. I use, you know, visceral brush strokes with, you know, these light glazes, basically back in, you know, Da Vinci's time in the high Renaissance of the Baroque period. You had artists like Caravaggio who were bringing in chiaroscuro and tenebrism, these techniques of light out of darkness and really dramatic you know, scenes that almost look like a, you know, Francis Ford Coppola movie of today. But yeah, I really honed in on those techniques and techniques that I learned at Iowa State University, and I use it to create my compositions.
When you talk about fantasy work, some of this work is so hyper realistic that almost seems to be a little anachronistic.
Yeah, it is. It is very hyper realistic. What I try to do, you know, I try to evoke, you know, my work's always been about the emotional side of the human condition. You know, I really, really want to tap into those, you know, social or political issues, or, you know, whether in fantasy, I really want to capture or captivate a cover, you know, when I'm creating something. For instance, Max Brooks, you know, World War Z, when I was creating that, I really wanted that cover to be very realistic, hyper real, but also have movement and emotional, you know, almost like it's an action, you know, like you're seeing an action film piece on a still frame.
What do you want people to feel when they look at something like that?
Well, you know, as artists, we always try to, you know, I try to, you know, really get the viewer to really engage into the pieces. And so I just want them to emotionally have something, you know, to bring something out of the viewer. And that's what I always try with my work. You know, I want it to hit home and it'll resonate with them in different ways. You know, some people, they will always bring their own, you know, feelings to a painting or a cover. And so I try to, you know, really capture whether it's a filmmaker's vision or my own vision or an author. I really want to bring that emotional content and, you know, make it visceral and just, you know, really push the limits of what a painting can do.
When did you start illustrating?
Great question. Back in 2000, I started my first website, and I had an author named Douglas Clegg write to my website and ask for if he could buy one of my paintings for his book cover. And from there, it was with Cemetery Dance. It was the publication company, and they also published a lot of Stephen King's work. Well, King and a lot of the other authors really liked what I was doing with my work, and they were seeing that old emotional, you know, kind of Renaissance technique, and so they brought me in on other projects, and here I am. I've done over, you know, almost 100 novels now and working on concept art for films now.
Is that where you saw yourself going when you started out?
Absolutely not. It was crazy. I always thought I would go to New York City and, you know, try to get into a gallery and be that artist, you know, and make my way that way. But I guess it just, you know, life works in, you know, mysterious ways for sure. It's just, it's taken on a whole new realm. I still do the gallery shows. I do museum talks, lectures like I'm doing this week here at Iowa State University. And yeah, it just, I never knew it would go this far in this direction, but I just, you know, go for the ride. And I guess whenever, as artists, I always have my work ready. So if a door opens, you know, it just opens up to more opportunities. And I just love creating and being with creative teams and people around me.
Even before you started illustrating, were you drawn to these sort of horror fantasy type things?
Well, so basically what I was pulled to was the human condition. So growing up, my grandfather came from Sicily, so we have a strong, you know, it was a strong Catholic background upbringing. So you're in the church, and then I was looking at these, you know, frescoes or the paintings on the wall of, you know, these, you know, massive scenes of Christ or, you know, the ascension, you know, of an angel or a saint. And so, you know, I always wanted to know the background, you know, why is this, you know, why is this person a martyr? What happened to this person? And so I guess those images really sank in with me, and not realizing that some of the pieces I was looking at were just kind of renditions of Caravaggio or Da Vinci. They were actually looking back to the Renaissance. So it did evoke a lot of emotion and, you know, pull a lot of those things from the past that really influenced my work.
When you're hired to do a book cover or a poster for a movie or something like that, how much freedom do you have in deciding what that will be?
In this regard, I feel really blessed because a lot of people, I hear all these stories about, you know, how art directors over, you know, rule over the artist and make them, you know, create their vision. But for me, it's been a different way. Since I've come in, mostly the authors, publishers, or movie companies really like my vision. So they will tell me the concept. We'll just talk about, like, you know, what the idea is. Or if it's Max Brooks, maybe, you know, I get to read the story. And then from there, they usually go with my vision. With the Max Brooks cover, with that, I was trying to create, you know, not the typical zombie that you're seeing every day nowadays, you know, leaning forward and stuff. I really tried to create this dead soul that was kind of, you know, with this halo above its head and caught in between a heaven and hell situation and then being reanimated and coming back to life. So I try to pull my vision, and then I usually show it to the author or the filmmaker, and I've been lucky every time they just go with my vision, which I feel really lucky.
I mentioned that in this slideshow you can see disturbing pictures. You can also see incredibly beautiful pictures. And in a news release, Iowa State University published a couple of your pictures. One is called Birth of Spring, and it has a beautiful little girl, and there are butterflies. And yeah. It's really a lovely, lovely image.
Yeah.
When you create things that are so horrific or ugly, does that worry you? Does that scare you a little bit that you can create something so scary?
Well, no, it really doesn't. What I've always tried to do is be like a witness of what happens. When you say that, it's kind of funny because, you know, in society, people come see a painting and they get scared. You know, they're scared to death of my work. But yet, you know, every day, look, you know, you're reading about whether it's a bombing or a shooting or something. You know, to me, the real news scares me even more. But, you know, it's funny how it, to me, not funny, but, you know, it's just when you have a painting and somebody has to be engaged in front of a painting, it really emotionally can affect them. And like with Birth of Sunrise and Birth of Spring, those are, for every piece that I do that's kind of harsh and, you know, what I consider harsh, you know, for me to even paint. I also have those paintings like the one you brought up. And those are like for me, those are visions that I can just relax. You know, when I paint like Birth of Spring, it's this beautiful, tranquil piece. And it's just a little more, it helps me, you know, come down from creating some of that other stuff that's so harsh.
With some of the harsher work, knowing that it will be, you know, if it's on the cover of a book, it will be mass produced and in the homes of many, many people.
Yes.
Do you ever feel concerned about the voyeuristic aspect of what you're creating and that when you're creating something that you may want to evoke empathy or you may want people to think about how ugly it is, that maybe somebody's enjoying that?
Yeah, that is kind of scary. I actually did there was a series I was doing, that was the same thing emotionally. I was trying, it was dealing with, some of it was dealing with rape and different issues. And those were more social issues, not so much the book cover issues. And it was a grant that was given to me to really look at that. And what I was looking at in society is, you know, you could either be the person who's doing this or the person who could help the person in the situation. And I was trying to do, it was kind of like a case study for me, you know, to see how people interpret artwork and different things. Usually my paintings, what I'm trying to evoke is just showing how society's, you know, taken, you know, gone down the wrong road. And, you know, I hope that they choose another path or another way out, you know, and showing them the worst so that they go home and they say, oh my God, I would never want that to happen to my family or, you know, my children. And so, you know, they really treasure what they have in life. You know, that's kind of, my work is always, you know, there's death and all these other themes, but there's also love and, you know, rebirth and things in my work that, you know, there's always another way out, another path for society to choose. And I just try to show them both sides so that they, you know, choose the lighter way.
How do you balance your work yourself? Do you need to do something that is brighter and more hopeful after doing something that is dark and frightening?
Oh, definitely, definitely. You know, when I look at art, I've always looked at it like, you know, it's this gift in life that, you know, you study it with the discipline of like a surgeon, you know, but you got to have the perseverance of a boxer and the reverence of a poet. You know, you're going through all this emotional side to things, and then I do need that balance. I need those whimsical. I also have this series I got to tell you real quick. It's called the Oppressed Fruit and Vegetable Series.
Right, so, I saw that.
So
I was very surprised. Well, and we should describe it a little bit. You have a banana that's basically been crucified. You have a pea pod that's been hung. It's really frightening stuff.
Okay, so let me tell you, those are actually funny. So my family's vegetarian, so I always had these fruits and vegetables laid around the house. And so sometimes, you know, I have my lunch or whatever, and I'm having a banana, and I threw the banana down, and when it landed, it looked like the banana Christ. It looked like this. I know it sounds odd, but anyway, it was in this position, and it looks like this crucifixion. So I painted it, and with the string bean looked like a little elf when it dried out. And so I painted this suicidal string bean and lemon piggies and all these other, because lemons always look, you know, like these little pigs.
And a very sensual pear,
to say. Which I call pear ass, but it's the, you know, just fun, you know, just fun, whimsical stuff. So those are a balance for me, you know, and I really enjoy doing those pieces. Now, I don't know what the public thinks of those, but, you know, for an artist, you know, I really, you know, I just try to paint for myself. And those are really ways for me to just let loose and let go.
Are you a father?
I am a father, yeah. And I have two children. My son, I named after the famous painter Caravaggio, and my daughter Vivian, 15 and 13 years old. My awesome wife, too.
When they were littler, when they were growing up, and they still are, clearly, yeah. But when they were younger, was there work that you did that you would not let them see?
No, I don't. I've never censored anything with my children. So they realize, you know, when we are on trips too, when we go to museums and everything, they get to see everything. And they're really artistic kids. They really understand, like, if they're looking at a nude figure or whatever it is, it's not something that's bad. You know, we just talk about issues and stuff. So I sometimes feel in society, rather than censor and hide things, I think it can be really rewarding for, you know, the kids to talk about things and what's going on. And I used, you know, my kids a lot in the paintings, actually, for models on certain things. But I always give them a little background. Now, for The Exorcist, I used my daughter on the cover image. But obviously, she has not read The Exorcist yet. But, you know, after high school, then she can. But, I really tell them what the book's about a little bit and give them the backgrounds. Or, you know, we talk about that stuff. So I try to keep it open-minded.
You are a young man, and you have this incredible body of work so far. What are your hopes for the future?
Oh boy, that's great. I've been doing a lot of self-publishing stuff, and the I before E, except after death, was just it was a little pun on, you know, don't get caught up in the grammar of life, you know, is what I was thinking about. You know, we're always worried about all these different things. And it's like, look at what's most important to you in your life and really hone in on those things. And so what I would like to do, I have some writings that I've done, and I'm probably going to bring some of those books to life in a Tim Burton-esque, you know, kind of way, where I would like to show some of those visions. And maybe, you know, I always would like to get into filmmaking at some point.
You're going to be talking tonight, I'm sure, to many art and design students who dream of having a career as successful as yours. And they're going into a field, or hoping to go into a field, that's not particularly practical. Probably their parents are saying, could you maybe get an accounting degree as well? What kind of advice can you give those students who are just starting out where you were in 1993?
Yeah, for me, the main thing is, you just do the work. You know, every night in your studio, you persevere and you work through it. You know, so many nights I thought I would get nowhere, you know, but I paint for myself, as I said before, but that's, you know, you have to go out and get it. If you want to make things happen, you have to be the change that you want to happen to you. So what I did is I just, you know, I looked at different avenues. I approached it in different ways. And as artists, there are lots of avenues, you know, whether it's a gallery system, or you want to work in a museum, or do you want to work in the film industry? There's all these opportunities for us. Society needs the creative people. And what I also find, you know I've done a lot of things, but I don't look at it like, you know, oh, I'm successful. I've never looked at it that way. You know, for everything that goes right, there's things that go wrong. So it's keeping a nice, even-keeled balance in all of that that has really helped me. You know, you stay focused on what you're doing and keep doing it, and don't, you know, waver from your vision, and whatever you'll persevere through it.
What are you most proud of that you've accomplished so far?
Wow. For me, you know, I guess one of the neatest things was back in 2004, New York City. I was brought into the Museum of Illustration, and they brought me to this. I made this show. It was a pretty big show. And so I got to show my work there. I was one of 50 artists chosen. And so here I was. I had my kids with me, my wife. And so they could actually see their dad's work, you know, on a museum wall. And I thought it was really neat. And here I was standing at a bar, and I looked up at the bar. There's a bar inside this museum, which is really old-fashioned museum. But what was really neat was I looked up, and it was Norman Rockwell on the wall at the same bar. And I thought, wow, this is cool. I've kind of made it.
That's great. Jeremy, thank you so much.
Oh, Charity, thank you for having me on the show.
Jeremy Canelia is an author, an artist, and an illustrator, and hoping to be an author as well. His work has been featured on the covers of more than 50 CDs and books by many, many people. He's also won the International Horror Guild Award for Best Artist in Dark Fantasy and Horror. He'll be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at Iowa State University in the auditorium at the College of Design. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, Ben Stanton, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. This is Talk of Iowa.